Hey, y'all. How's it going? Welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. There's wars on. I'm going to tell you about the news from them best I can. Also, I'm going to interview Clive Stafford Smith, who's some kind of Brit. I don't know. Irish or Scottish or Welsh or English or some kind of dang thing. But he's an American hero, this guy. He's going to be on the show to talk about all kinds of things. So I'm going to have to ask him really specific questions. So he doesn't go on too long so we can talk about this plethora of topics, wide and varied, with him. Three. Clive Stafford Smith. He'll be on the show later on. And then, well, god dang, I don't know, man. I guess I expect a few of these people will at least tell me no. But I've sent out a whole mess of invites and I don't know. I guess we will see what happens. I got up early today, but I guess I didn't start sending the invites right away. I need to get better about that. I really need to start planning the show in the days before, like it used to be back in the old days. But you do it, huh? It's my show, The Scott Horton Show, and, there's god dang catastrophe over there at the Turkish border. I guess, you know, I'm following Kobani on Twitter, the hashtag. There are a couple of good reporters there. What in the world? Oops. Yeah, there it is right there. I was following it, now I'm following it some more. They say that the Islamic State has control of about a third of the town. Oh, did I not explain? That's a town, a Kurdish town, in northern Syria on the Turkish border, and for a few days the Islamic State has been laying siege to it and attacking it and attempting to occupy it. And the Turks have been sitting there doing nothing. Because they hate the PKK and whatever other acronym for the Kurdish PKK-type rebels there. And so they're perfectly happy to sit and watch the Islamic State get slammed. And now apparently there's more and more American air power being deployed. But as Mitchell Prothero was explaining on the show, and it is a very important point, stationary targets like buildings are pretty easy to hit. You just type in the coordinates into the JDAM and drop it. But when you're talking about tanks on the battlefield, you really do need guys on the ground with lasers. Although, you know, I read a thing saying, yeah, no, drones can do it too, but they just don't have enough drones deployed there to shoot enough lasers, to laser enough targets for the fighter jets, to the, you know, fighter bombers to drop them. I don't know. What the hell do I know? But it seems like, obviously, that is a limitation. Got to have some kind of eyes on. Somebody calling in the airstrike, either with a laser pointer or just calling out coordinates, but from the ground. And so difficult to do. And so they were hoping the Turks would do it for them, but no. Turks are perfectly happy to sit there and let this continue on, I guess. And what's hilarious is on CNN I this morning, the Turks are saying, yeah, here are our conditions. We want a safe haven zone, whatever, something. Some kind of no-fly, no-drive zone enforced by NATO. Some sort of safe enclave for them to push all the refugees back into Syria, is what he means. And then he wants a no-fly zone, and he wants this rebel-held area to focus on Assad. That's his enemy. The Kurds and Assad. Not the Islamic State. Oh, yeah, I guess, you know. He'll give Obama copyright permission to use his name in the Coalition of the Willing. Yeah, Erdogan's with us, guys. You know, for a price. But he's not fighting the same war as the United States at all over there. Although I'm not sure the United States is fighting the same war the United States is fighting over there either, so I'll give him that. It does kind of seem like the Americans have a deal with Erdogan that, yeah, I guess we will just go ahead and let ISIS attack the Kurds some more for a while. Which is strange because it seems like they really need the goodwill. Maybe, I don't know. Maybe that's not right. The Americans, they need the goodwill of at least the Iraqi Kurds. They can't screw that up. Not yet, right? So, face value, the Americans are frustrated that the Turks won't intervene, but I don't know if that's really the whole truth or not. All right. Well, anyway. So, I'm Scott Horton, and I got a lot of news to cover. I guess I'll get back to that in a minute, but I wanted to just show you top story on antiwar.com today by Jason Ditz, news.antiwar.com. Obama, Congress must stop. You ready? Quote, draconian cuts to military spending. And I was thinking that, no, you must be lying. Did he say draconian? Yeah. The sequestration deal in Congress, which is ridiculous. This is a slight curb on the rate of growth of spending in the Pentagon budget. Give me a break. Who's going to even call that a cut anyway? And they've done away with all the rules, and they're doing whatever they want anyway. And they're already spending $1 trillion a year on national security. I mean, just the Pentagon budget plus the war budget is $500 billion. It's $500 billion for these kooks. And then, well, it's more than that, really. It's more like $600 or $700 billion. And then the rest is Homeland Security and the CIA and blah, 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 all that. The money spent federalizing your local police forces. That kind of thing. $1 trillion a year. And it was funny, I tweeted that and one guy responded, is this real life? Like that kid who goes to the dentist and he's on laughing gas and he's trying to figure out what the hell is going on. Remember that? Oh, viral YouTube. Is this real life, Dad? What the? Draconian cuts to the Pentagon? Who ever heard of that? Oh, what he's saying is, we want more money for the Pentagon. Oh, okay. Translated from Washington, D.C. into American English. More money. For the wars. Would you believe the nerve of these guys? Of course you would. Anyway, I just like bring that to attention. And then here's another one that I'll just fit in here in a couple minutes before the first break, because I don't want to dwell on this kind of thing because I'll be too insulting about it, and I don't want to be too insulting about it. But oh, there's big right-wing scaremongering going around. Should have seen all the terrified, besweated tweets. The best source of information ever, a right-wing congressman, says that he heard from a Border Patrol guy that they have been arresting ISIS terrorists, at least 10, he said, down at the Mexican border. And you know who it is it's that jerk Duncan Hunter who ran for president on the Let's Blow Up China ticket back in 2007 and 8. It's his son. Yeah, well, I got told that by this guy, he said. But, yeah, anyway, here's the kind of lie that couldn't possibly be true. Come on, man. Does anybody really believe that? That they got 10 Iraqis, Syrian, Libyans, something. They snuck them into Mexico, and all these guys went and they all grew mustaches and got straw hats and came to pretend that they were here to swing hammers. Got the Rosetta Stone and practiced their Spanish on the way, so they just fit right in. I mean, Arabs and Mexicans, they all look alike, right? So sneak across the border. That's what conservatism means. Believing things that couldn't possibly be true. And then the next day, believing more things that couldn't possibly be true, too. Conservatism. Oh, yeah, and a bloodlust. Hey, all, Scott Horton here to let you know Pizza Noir, Book 1 by Denver Day is now available at your local bookstore and Amazon.com. Grab a cold cup of coffee and follow Tacoma, Washington Detective Rick Thompson as he investigates the mystery behind the mass murder of dozens of hot young strippers and roller derby girls all across the West while he learns new things about the world and himself.
Pizza Noir, Book 1 by Denver Day. Normal, as we knew it, is a thing of the past. Find it at scotthorton.org/books or scotthorton.org/Amazon.
Hey, I'm Scott. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. Coming up on the show, Clive Stafford Smith. Well, that'll be later on. You don't have to wait around. I don't do all that PR stuff where I go, coming up, a very special guest, and you'll have to stay tuned to find out who, and a bunch of crap. You know, just, it's going to be Clive Stafford Smith. He's great, so that'll be good enough. I don't really like jerking people around very much, you know. So, yeah, I don't know. The reports are that the Islamic State control as much as a third of the country, but then again, well, I don't know. CENTCOM says they've done 5 airstrikes. Here's who to look at on Twitter if you're into the Twitter thing here. Jenan Musa. And that's J-E-N-A-N. Well, you know what? Just go and look at all the top tweets under the hashtag Cobain, and you'll find her there. She's wearing a blue shirt in her picture. Jenan Musa. And then Harold Dornbos. Harold Dornbos. You'll find him. There are a couple of reporters there. I forget who all they write for. Who's this guy saying he writes for? The Post Online from, I have no idea what country. And then she's at Alon TV, whatever the hell that is. Arabic Al-On TV. Anyway, they've been reporting there for quite a while. Past few days I've been watching them. And so the refugees, they're with the refugees on the Turkish side of the border, watching what's happening. And it doesn't seem like too much, I don't know. It doesn't seem like ISIS has taken the city, that's true. It's funny that in Washington, D.C., it seems like there's a... Oh, man, now I hope I remember what I was going to refer to here about this, but it seems like this is a real question of whether this is going to work or not, whether this is going to make or break. Oh, I know, I retweeted the guy what said this before. How did I get to my page from here now? They changed everything on Twitter again. Oh, I know who it was. It was that guy from the Brookings Institution, the so-called terrorism expert guy from Brookings. What's his name? Lister, Charles Lister. He says, ISIS clearly under more pressure today with intensified coalition strikes. Should Cobain still end up falling, it'll be a damning indictment. And I think you're going to see a lot of that. I think you're going to see damning indictments until the Marines invade. And then you'll see more damning indictments. It's never enough. You know, it's America's Keynesian foreign policy, like Paul Krugman. You just haven't inflated enough. You just haven't invaded enough. It's the same damn thing. And when, I guess, finally following this chain of logic, I don't know how to escape it. Unless you put me in charge or something. Otherwise, on this chain of logic, they're going to end up having to send the whole damn Marine Corps to kick the Islamic State out of these cities. There's not enough other people's boots on the ground that they can hire to do this. I mean, I don't know. The Sunni tribes can do it, but under American auspices, it seems to me more likely to completely blow up in their face. That they're better left to their own devices to figure out what to do. You know, because of the local information problem. Trying to redo the Sunni awakening without the 150,000 troops there, 130, whatever, there to help them accomplish their mission. Yeah, a little bit less likely that way. Just let them handle it themselves. And enough of this inclusive government in Baghdad. There's not going to be an inclusive government in Baghdad. That's what they're saying about the awakening, that a body is going to create a new National Guard, and it's going to be all Sunni tribal men in this National Guard to fight against ISIS under the direction of Baghdad. Yeah, I'll believe it when I see it. I mean, whose palms has a body got to grease to get Sunni Stan back under the control of Baghdad? What, he's got a magic wand or something? That is not happening. It's not happening. The independence of Sunni Iraq is already a fact. You know, Kurdish autonomy and de facto independence, that level of independence has already been far surpassed by Sunni Stan, and there ain't no going back. Whether it's under Baghdadi and the Islamic State or anybody else, just under their tribal system. Putting them back under the fold of the Baghdad government? Yeah, no. It didn't work back in 2007 with all the American money and American troops in the world to make it happen. It didn't happen. The surge worked, accomplished one thing, getting people in your neighborhood to memorize a slogan and believe it. That's it. The surge didn't do a damn thing other than kill people. No, the surge worked at helping Iran and their militias kick all the Sunnis out of Baghdad. It did help with that. But really, that was pretty much done mostly before the surge. It's just the mopping up. It was the El Salvador option worked. That was what got rid of the Sunnis out of there 2 years before. The surge was when they bought off the tribes to finish off Al-Qaeda and the war against the Sunni insurgency ended. They'd turn around and beat up on Sadr for a while to no effect whatsoever other than to kill innocent people. He's still a major part of the coalition of the Shiite government of the country, so. The surge worked. Well, let's see. The benchmark for success, you know, Donald Rumsfeld and his metrics were replaced by Robert Gates and his benchmarks. We don't have any metrics or benchmarks. We need to come up with a category so that we can measure whether we're ever, you know, making it real. These guys in the middle of a war. So they came up with these benchmarks, and the benchmarks were everything in Baghdad is going to go so swimmingly from now on without any Sunnis in it. And it'll be so peaceful there that the Shiites will happily allow the Sunni quote-unquote leaders to come to Baghdad and collect a bunch of money and happily be part of the government. Except that the Shiites never did that. The first thing Maliki did when America left was put a hit out on the vice president. I mean, I'm sure he was guilty as hell of murder and everything, but that was part of the compromise with all these gangsters, was that they're compromising. But oh, now all of a sudden there's a rule of law for this vice president guy who had ended up fleeing to Kurdistan and then eventually to Qatar, I think. Or Bahrain. And then Maliki never did put all of Sunni Stan on the oil welfare payroll. He never did incorporate them into the army, never did incorporate them into the police forces, never did pay them to create their own police forces, really, or to continue the ones that had been created under Petraeus. In fact, you go and look at this whole thing, it not only didn't work, it completely backfired. Because in financing the Sunni insurgency and bribing them to stop fighting, it really solidified their power separate from Baghdad. It was the beginning. He subsidized the beginning of all of their institutions. I mean, at the same time, of course, they're destroying the last reason the Shiites had to compromise with the Sunnis ever again at that point, too. And I don't mean the people. I mean the power leaders of these factions, of course. But also, they started creating the Sunni state with the awakening movement that ISIS just came and took over. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. And quickly here, I don't know, maybe I can spend some time on it. So I saw Roseanne Barr, who I guess, part of me still loves Roseanne Barr because, man, I always did ever since she was first doing stand-up. I used to watch her when I was a little kid, you know? But the thing is, in her Twitter life, she's the most horrible Zionist apologist for any old war crime. And she's just about as unhinged as can be. And I saw it where she tweeted out this morning this video about the horrors of anti-Semitism on American campuses. Oh, never again, they cried. And what? First of all, I've never seen such waspy-looking Jews in my life if these people were in fact Jewish. I mean, I don't know. Obviously, yeah, that's kind of a stupid thing to say. Jews can look like lots of things, but they seem like all very rich little white boys, not really like you would even think upper-middle-class Jewish kids, right? They seem like very upper-class white kids. And they're all at a young Republican-type thing organized by Frank Luntz. There's Frank Luntz in the middle of the thing, passing around the mic. And every kid is encouraged to tell their horror story of anti-Semitism. And there's like a total of two fistfights in the whole thing. And they were both, admittedly, by these guys, the way they tell the story, their fault. For, yeah, it was three of us walked right up into a protest by a bunch of people on the other side, and it turned into a fight. Other times, these are cited, these are included by the editor. Well, we had a table, and some people came up and protested us. And there were a lot of people were crying. I mean, it was really scary. Wait, what? I didn't hear the scary part. And there were a couple of fistfights, and then they said that they claimed, a couple of them claimed that they had gotten into fights with actual Nazis, which I suppose is possible, I guess, you know? But mostly, all their examples of anti-Semitism were like nothing. Maybe names called. Names called? And whatever, I come from partially a Jewish heritage, and I married a Jewish lady, and I'm no anti-Semite or anything, but I am against a bunch of crap coming from anybody. And so Frank Luntz, you know, is gonna have to be a target from time to time here. This ridiculous propaganda that somehow Jews are under siege on American campuses. This one kid talks about being out at a protest, at a big thing, getting into a big fight among a bunch of people that, and he was part of it. And now he's watching his back everywhere he goes, blah, blah, blah. And yet he has no example of anyone following him anywhere or do anything to him, harassing him. He was just at a thing that erupted into a couple of punches thrown one time. You know, come on, man. There's no anti-Semitism in America, not really. I bet you if you took all of the, you know, public critics of Israel, including everybody on Twitter who just ain't like Israel and what they do, and everybody, and put them all together, I bet probably 2 or 3% of those are even anti-Semites. 2 or 3% of those are either Arabs or white people who would say the problem is Jews. Nobody believes that. That's stupid. And don't anybody go and copy and paste that one tiny little part of my sentence out of context. God dang it. Come on. Jews are not under threat just because Arabs on American campuses want to organize groups against Israeli policies. They cite literally in this video, you can go watch it. I think I retweeted her, or I at least replied to her, so you could find it on my feed if you want on twitter.com/Scott Horton Show. We were protested, a lot of us were crying and whatever. Their example of anti-Semitism is people saying Intifada and Free Palestine. What? Are you kidding me? I mean, how is this supposed to convince American Jews, even? It seems like they would all watch this and say, well, this is pretty thin gruel. Intifada means uprising. Well, you gotta have a boot on your neck to uprise against, or an uprising ain't an uprising at all. Intifada doesn't mean launch aggressive war. Intifada means you're oppressed in the first place. The victim in the first place. Attempt to throw off the yoke around your neck is what Intifada means. How in the hell is that anti-Semitic? Especially when you're talking about a bunch of Semite Arabs living in Semite land occupied by people who mostly are Eastern European Jews who are refugees from, you know, first, obviously, well, not first, but mostly the two biggest phases, refugees from World War II and then from the fall of the Soviet Union as well, who most of whom are Semites in only the very most technical sense. Come on. And they all have the right of return, but the people who are from there don't. Come on, man. Anti-Semitism to say free Palestine? That doesn't even say turn Israel back into Palestine, right? Like the obvious, and I'm not putting words in people's mouth. Maybe that is what some of them mean, and they have every right to say that, and I don't mean to spin it. But I'm just saying to my ears, the most obvious interpretation of that is let the people in the West Bank and East Jerusalem and the Gaza Strip and the Golan Heights, let them be free. Instead of under a foreign military occupation. Generation after generation, longer than the Soviets occupied Eastern Europe. Free Palestine? Is anti-Semitism? That's really the best you got? You can't show me one guy saying what ought to happen to all Jews somewhere? Show me one guy saying that. Come on. Nope. Can't find it. And, you know, I violently, coin a phrase, as a figure of speech, I violently disagree with anybody who's sectarian about any religion or ethnic group or any of that crap. Like, and I'm sorry to the right-wingers, because I don't mean it in, like, an annoying socialist pro-government way, but I'm just natural, born as politically correct as can be. I'm an individualist, so therefore, I hate anyone who would be so stupid and crass as to make all their distinctions about other people on religious and ethnic lines. What are you, stupid? I hate that crap. But I also hate a bunch of whining and crying and lying about how anyone who opposes the murderous, criminal policies of the government of Israel is somehow guilty of being the worst kind of bigot. That is such a damned lie. Oh, one time I was at a pro-Israel protest and someone else came up and protested against me. So that makes me a victim now. Help! What? What are you talking about? Help. What anti-Semitism among a bunch of Semite Arabs on American campuses who have the right to speak? And of course, that's what Frank Luntz is up to here. These children are all just, well, you know, young adults. They're all just props in the Israel lobby's scheme to outlaw anti-Israeli speech and activities on American campuses, which is where, for some reason, the First Amendment doesn't apply there because, what, little kids' feelings? Or what is the problem again? Where the First Amendment doesn't apply and speech codes come into practice on American campuses? Oh, yeah, and anyone who disapproves of Netanyahu, Benjamin Adam Lanza Netanyahu, murdering children. Oh, he just hates Netanyahu for being Jewish, not for the children that he kills, because what kind of craziness is that? Give me a break. None of this survives the slightest bit of examination, please. Frank Luntz. Hey, Al Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. Darrenscoffee.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. You know, I'll tell you a thing. My wife, you might know her, Larissa Alexandrovna. She's a reporter for RawStory.com for many years. And, well, she's written a great many things and broken a hell of a lot of great stories. But one thing about her is that after Mel Gibson went on his drunken tirade to the cop who was busting him for drunk driving or whatever that night, and everybody reacted so horrified
Which, like, hey, I grant you some horrified or something. But she wrote this thing basically along the lines of, oh, please. You know, anti-Semitism means things happening to you, dude. Not somebody said something one time, political correct, hurt your feelings. Shut up. And that's because she's from the communist Soviet Union, where hating Jews was a matter of government policy. And they suffered especially compared to everybody else who already were all slaves. So, you know, and even as far as the name calling and whatever, I mean, give me a break. Open white supremacist movement in America has never been more marginal. They have absolutely no influence over even the minds of anyone. I mean, give me a break. Nobody believes in that. No one believes in, you know, or no one with any influence believes in white supremacism at all. And it's not like, oh yeah, thank God we're doing such a great job at tamping it down or whatever. No, those beliefs are discredited. They're discredited. You know, not that, oh, there's no racism. Obviously the state, you know, the government cops kill a black guy a day. It's their quota or whatever their problem is. I'm not saying racism's over, but I'm just saying, you know, open agendas of white supremacy over blacks or Jews or anyone else in America, nobody believes in that crap. That is not a threat right now. And trying to dress up all opposition to Israel as that kind of bigotry, well, you know, eventually there, you know, become other problems with that. First of all, that's really rude to accuse people of good faith of being some kind of bigot beyond the pale. But also, it makes you look rude. Frank Luntz. Makes the Israel lobby look like a bunch of Frank Luntzes. And then that becomes problematic too, because then how do you spin that? If the whole country says, oh, we love Jews, but boy, just whenever Frank Luntz tells people to say things, it comes out really dishonest. So maybe you should deal honestly with the question of Israel-Palestine instead of just accusing everybody who tries to of being some kind of monster. Especially after, look what just happened with this Operation Protective Edge, where by all of their own measures, the Israelis accomplished nothing. They just massacred a bunch of people, destroyed what little property they had for nothing. It's just a canned hunt. Like Dick Cheney up against a panther, only he's got real hunters with him to make sure he's okay. And there's a gigantic fence with a ceiling, too. You know? The panther can't escape. Dick Cheney and his actual hunters are big men on the prowl. I'm just making that one up, but you know they do canned hunts and all that kind of crap. You know what I mean. You know Dick Cheney doesn't do real hunting. Not even against a deer. It's got to be a setup for him. Anyway. And you know what's funny is I think it really doesn't work anymore. I think that what happened was too many people who clearly were not anti-Semites were accused of being anti-Semites in a row, where people just kind of said, yeah, whatever. Anyway, so the point that we were talking about was that the people of East Jerusalem have been rendered the people of Eastern Jerusalem under Israeli control, step by step, piece by piece, including having their cemeteries paved over so that the Israelis can build a museum of tolerance over it. You know that really happened? You couldn't put that in a comic book. You couldn't put that in anti-Semitic propaganda. That the Israelis would pave over a cemetery and then build a museum, an ancient one, or at least a you know, yeah, more than 150 years or something, that ain't ancient, but I think actually they claimed it went back way further than that. I forget now. But anyway, hundreds of years old, people's ancestors buried in the ground. The Israelis come, they built a museum of tolerance on top of it. Yeah, don't you say intifada, that's anti-Semitic. You will tolerate. Because you have no choice, because the Americans are footing the bill, that's why. Crazy. But yeah, I don't think that works anymore. You know what? We owe thanks to Walt and Mearsheimer, neither of whom are anti-Semites at all, for I think really helping break through on that. Because boy, were they called anti-Semites. And they are just such professors. They just responded the way a professor would, which is, well, you know, that's not true. I like Jews just fine. That's, you know. And people said, oh, well, yeah, he doesn't really seem anti-Semitic, does he? Yeah, he's actually really not, is he? No. Oh, okay, huh. So maybe there are reasons to criticize Israel that I've never heard of? Could it really be? No way. Anyway. Frank Luntz. Frank Luntz is the guy who, you see him on Fox News all the time during the debates, during the big political campaigns. He runs the focus groups and stuff. And he's the guy that put out public relations advice for the Israel lobby about how to talk to Americans about Israel. And every bit of it is about how to lie to them. Every bit of it is about how to turn the truth completely upside down and confuse the issue and trick Americans into supporting Israel. I mean, you read it and there's no other way around it. That's what it's about. How to Lie Americans into Supporting Israel by Frank Luntz. In fact, here, let me see if I can find it. First, I start with a PDF, and then I go Frank Luntz advice to Israel something. I don't know. That's a, yeah, here it is. The second result, the Israel Project's 2009 Global Language Dictionary. Oh, how could I have forgotten? The Israel Project's 2009 Global Language Dictionary. And you can read the whole thing online. It's a PDF file. And all these are the recommendations. Well, as it's summed up here, how do you sell the American public on the idea that Israel has the right to maintain or even expand Jewish settlements on the West Bank? Be positive. Turn the issue away from settlements and toward peace. Invoke ethnic cleansing. Yeah, invoke ethnic cleansing. That the mean old Palestinian Arab supremacists refuse to allow the Jewish settlers to be there and are trying to ethnically cleanse them out, even though none of those Palestinians have a right to return to their land, their father's land, their grandfather's land in what we call Israel whatsoever. In fact, the fact that my grandmother was Jewish means I have the right to go and be on the dole in Israel in a settlement on the West Bank, even though I'm from Austin, Texas, and I don't identify with Israel in the slightest bit whatsoever. They would identify me as good enough to help populate that land that they're stealing. They're invading and occupying somebody else's land. This has been illegal under international law since Hitler and Lebensraum. And I'm sorry, I don't speak German. Lebensraum? Lebensraub? Is there a B? No. It's just the one B. Lebensraum, I think it is. And it means breathing space. It means we're going to kill these people and take their land and grow wheat on it. And, I mean, that's the original German. But this is the thing that's been outlawed under the UN, under the United States enforcement, to certain degrees, since World War II, in certain cases. You're not allowed to colonize land that you win in a war. In fact, if you win land in a war, you're responsible for the people there for a short period of time until you can stabilize the thing, and then you have to leave. You can't keep it. That's against the law now to keep it, and that's what they're doing. And for them to invoke ethnic cleansing, what Frank Luntz is saying is, hey, you stupid idiot American, here's a lie, believe it. Don't learn anything about it, just believe it. It's the Palestinians who are ethnically cleansing the Israelis. Ha! And if you don't like that, you're an anti-Semite. Yeah, that's right there in the Israel Project's Global Language Dictionary. How to lie to Americans so they'll like you, in spite of the truth. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. So, coming up on the show, Clive Stafford Smith will be on to talk about a few different things. Important ones. Mostly Guantanamo and Pakistan, I'll tell you now. And then Michael T. Clare is going to be here. He's got a new one for Tom Dispatch about the oil wars. And what I like about this guy, well, you know how Gareth Porter is some kind of left-winger? I mean, it's not like he's a communist or anything, but he's some kind of progressive or something like that. However, you don't hear Gareth going on and on about the capitalists and this and that. Because for him, the enemy is the empire. But even then, as a left-winger, you might think he'd mention Exxon and Lockheed more often or something. But no, for him, it's all about the generals. There's no one more responsible for the pressure to maintain the empire in the United States than the generals, by a factor of a hell of a lot. And yeah, Exxon is Exxon and everything, but don't waste my time, because what we're talking about here is the Pentagon. They are the empire. And that's the center of the thing. The state. Its military arm. Exxon, well, yeah, I mean, they have a say. I don't think anybody's writing them off. But it's not just so simple as a lot of this stuff. Well, so here's Michael Clare. He is some kind of left-winger. I think probably, like Gareth, some kind of progressive. And his whole beat is about the global oil market. And he's kind of an environmentalist, global warming and all that crap, too. However, he's not crying about blood for oil. But this is somehow all about stealing the oil from the Middle East. And, of course, there are profits to be had there by Exxon and their cousins when it comes to pumping that oil and skimming those profits. But that's not the real name of the game. It's the Pentagon. It's the empire. And so any liberal or left-winger who would tend to have more of an anti-corporate bias than an anti-government bias, who is able to get through that and still really, point out how the problem is one of imperial strategy, much more than just, like in the myth, stealing oil so Americans can have it cheap. So I give him extra credit, bonus points for that, if you know what I mean. I guess I take too long to explain it. But you know what I mean. If a left-winger understands that the state is the worst player in something, then that shows a level of sophistication that you wouldn't really expect, kind of thing. That's what I'm saying. I mean, not that you wouldn't expect it from Gareth Porter. And in fact, Michael Clare, he seems like a pretty smart guy, too. I'm not saying it's impossible. But anyway. So he's going to be on to talk about exactly that. To talk about war. I screwed it all up. To talk about oil as a weapon in war. Oil as part of the imperial push and pull and control of other people's countries. So, of course, Iran, Russia, these things, Syria and their pipeline. It's at tomdispatch.com right now. It'll be at antiwar.com tomorrow. And so you should take a look at that. Mm-hmm. And then, let's see. Oh, here he is in my email. Oh, good. He's going to be there. Thought that might have been bad news. All right. And then let's see what else we got here. I spent a lot more time on the Roseanne thing than I ever meant to, that's for sure. Did you hear that the cops killed another black guy in Ferguson? Now, his friends and family say he had a sandwich. There's a sandwich in his hand. He just went into the store and bought a sandwich. It was a sandwich. Cop says, he shot 3 times at me. I presume the cop is guilty. What about you? How about when I add this detail? The guy was shot 17 times. 17 times? Hey, chat room guys, help me out. How many how many bullets can you fit in a magazine in the handle of a, you know, I don't know, 9mm Glock? Is that what the cop's carrying? How many bullets you fit in one of those things? Did he have to change, did he definitely have to change out the magazine to continue shooting this guy's dead body? Yeah, off-duty cop moonlighting as security guard. Yeah, I read that too. That was supposedly one of the updates. That's NCAP man in the chat room says that. Come on, one of you guys has got to be a gun guy. How many rounds does a sandwich hold? None. But no, man, the cop shot the victim 17 times. So did he have to actually dump a magazine, reload, recock, and then blam the guy more times? Riddle the dead body with more bullets? Huh. And then it's amazing that it just happens to be... Come on, somebody's a gun guy in the chat room. Let me know, for crying out loud. Or somebody tweet me or something. Oh, here we go. Expert answers. 17 rounds. Because of its unsurpassed reliability, above average magazine capacity of 17 rounds in the standard magazine, and its low weight, it's entrusted by law enforcement officers around the globe. There you go. A Glock 17. He dumped the full mag. Thank you, ATK. Man, this guy even logged in to tell me, hey, thanks, man. I appreciate that, because I don't know these things. Glock 17. ANCAP man and ATK something. Thanks, guys. Oh, yeah, here we go. Now I got instant messages going off on my phone, too. Got Sneaker chiming in. Everybody's like, yeah, wait, let me get my gun and count. Oh, yeah, that must be why they call it a Glock 17. Shows what I know about guns. But anyway, so there you go. This cop, boy, did he murder this guy to death. Well, why are you running if you're not guilty of a death penalty offense then? Bang, 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 bang. You're dead. Well, whatever. The grand jury, breaking news, everybody. The grand jury's returned a no bill. They said, well, wait, the guy doing the murdering was a cop, right? And the prosecutor nodded. And they said, and the guy that he killed was a black guy? And the prosecutor said, yeah, that's right. I have access to the secret grand jury information, you understand? And then the grand jury said, no, Bill! No, Bill! I'll tell you what, here's what we should do. Let's go ahead and give him the 2 weeks vacation, and then when he gets back, we'll throw him a pizza party. All right. You know, my cousin's brother's former roommate gets a kickback every time you gotta reload 17 bullets in your gun. So, I'll spring for the cake. It'll be a big thing. I know, I said, the mindset is discredited, but I guess I should have mentioned that. Oh yeah, no, you can, if you're a white supremacist, you can still be a cop. It's still acceptable. In one line of work left in America. Somehow they got exempt from that no discrimination policy that applies to everybody else. Like the Congress. And then, here's the other thing I was going to say about this. It just so happens, guys. It just so happens that it wasn't just somewhere. It was in St. Louis. It was in St. Louis. Where another young black male secretly recorded the cops, threatening they were going to entrap him for a possession of a gun that they had, even though he's on parole, probation, whatever. He's facing 9 years if he gets revoked. He's trying to be a good guy. The cops say, we have a gun. We're gonna say that we found it on you. And then you're gonna go to prison for 9 years. And your only way out of that is for you to find us someone else to entrap with the gun. And here he's recording them all along saying, I swear, just give me more time. By this time tomorrow, by 4 o'clock tomorrow afternoon, I'll get you somebody, I swear. And they say, well, you better.
And then he went and took it to his lawyer, who took it to the local news. Not that anybody got in trouble over it, but he didn't either. Thank goodness. It was the St. Louis cops. Out of 18,000 police departments in America. Same ones. They like planting guns.
Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And so there's a few things. I don't know. Everybody really likes being afraid of stuff, I guess. Maybe I could make more money and get more people to be anti-war if I would just couch all of this in fear all the time. Bush and Obama's policies are going to get you killed. Blowback is deadly. You could die any day now because of the terrible consequences of killing people mercilessly all the time. Which also is really expensive, which is why you can't afford the things that you want. So buy stuff for me, because it's an emergency. An emergency. People like being scared of things. People like being scared of China. A whole bunch. In fact, here at Truth Dig, the nice little progressives over there at Truth Dig, they get a big close-up of a picture of Mao Zedong on the Chinese currency. But boy, it was scary, Mao. Keep him away from me, man. Except that he's been dead since longer than I've been alive. So that's one thing. And communism in China went with him when he died. Longer ago than I've been alive. I mean, yeah, it's still the Communist Party dictatorship, but that's not really necessarily communism. To get rich is glorious, don't you know? And so, Truth Dig joins in the fear-mongering with, I hadn't checked, but I'm sure Drudge and the rest. IMF says, China replaces U.S. as world's largest economy. So I guess, it's sort of like Bush in Iraq. I don't really explain why I'm supposed to be afraid, but I guess I am, and so maybe I'll just start imagining that might mean something terrible for me if it's true. Might it? I don't know. What? Maybe if Chinese people have more money, they'll want more of what I got. I don't know. I'll try to sell them some stuff for a change. Well, then, you actually read the article, and this one said Truth Dig. You read the thing. That, you have to grade China on a $7.5 trillion curve in order to say that their economy is bigger than the economy of the United States. $7.5 trillion curve. Now, I know the U.S. economy is a bunch of smoke and mirrors, but boy, you want to talk about smoke and mirrors. See, it's not communism over there in China. You know what it is? It's fascism, like here in America, only worse. And so, you could call them Keynesians. You know what they like to do? Print money. And in fact, part of the problem is they do so much business with us that everybody's trying to manipulate the currencies to keep their trade balances just right the way they like them and this and that kind of crap. So what do? They print money. And then who gets the money? Just like in America, the politically connected. You know? Yes, it's true in fascism that government controls all the private property. Yes, it's nominally private, but government controls it all. Yeah, but that's because the ones who own the most of it want it that way. They control it all by, sometimes the state has more influence and sometimes the property owners. It goes back and forth, but certainly it's not like all the zillionaires in America are all a bunch of libertarians. Hell no. They're a bunch of fascists. That's why it's like this. And same thing in China. And so what does that mean?
That means bubbles. That's what it means, just like in America. It means artificial prosperity in certain sectors until the truth comes to town and kicks everybody's ass and sends them home again. And then they start inflating the bubbles all over again. The single best and never debunked and all-encompassing explanation all you need is found in Ludwig von Mises, or I guess it's Ludwig von Mises, in his book, The Theory of Money and Credit. He says, you know what causes the so-called business cycle? Government. Central banks, in concert with the private banks, working together to expand the amount of credit, money, in the economy, leading to malinvestments, where there's too much money going to sectors, artificially propping up prices and creating asset bubbles and causing collapses. In China, here's how it works. They build entire cities. You won't believe me until you Google it, unless you already know it, in which case you don't need to believe me because you already know it. But if you don't know this, you won't believe me until you double-check me. You'll think that, come on, that guy Scott Horton couldn't possibly be right about this. You go and double-check, and you will find ghost cities. And I don't mean like towns. I mean metropolises. I mean like trying to be downtown Dallas. I mean, I'm a Texan, so that's my comparison. Big-ass, like, real cities. Like a Shanghai. Only in the middle of nowhere. And there's nothing going on there. And there's no businesses there. And the only private people who own property there are just trying to flip it. And they're living in a bubble fantasy and trying to not be the last guy standing when the music stops. And there's not enough chairs left. Entire cities. Because that's how much totalitarian control over their fascist economy the government in Beijing has. So that means that some guy's cousin can get away with funneling that much money to a project that's worthless. I mean, you think about the vast inflation of the housing markets in Florida and in California and Las Vegas especially, right? Take the worst examples during the last housing bubble here, where in Southern California you had, I don't know about entire towns, maybe entire towns, mostly entire suburbs, you know, 4 or 5 valleys, maybe more, I don't know, in a row, full of suburbs that really nobody wants. Pretty damn overbuilt. I don't know, maybe it was worse than that, but pretty damn overbuilt. Prices pretty far out of control. And then, of course, all the investment instruments and all that property way, way, way out of control on a worldwide basis. But have you ever heard of a downtown Dallas, a gigantic entire city centrally planned by national politicians in America in a place where nobody wants to live there? There are no businesses. There are no people. I mean, it's unimaginable. Not even in America could you get away with that, dude. There's got to be a correction at some point. Jesus. Let Greenspan retire. Let Bernanke raise the federal funds rate 0.25 and stop this madness. But over there in China, and it's not just one. There's, I don't know how many more. More than 2 entire cities. Entire, like, real big cities. Not like Austin. Like Dallas. And I don't mean including Irving and all the other cities that are basically stuck to Dallas. But I mean, like, downtown real-ass Dallas is still huge. Not even downtown, but just actual Dallas, the city, limits. You're just talking about a huge city. In China, they've got at least a few of these whose prices are due to collapse. They got some major corrections coming. They have no military to challenge ours, except a Coast Guard, really. So, chill. You hate government, one of them libertarian types, or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and this is my show, The Scott Horton Show.
Our first guest up on the show today is Clive Stafford Smith, the founder of Reprieve. And he's doing so many great things on so many great issues. It's hard to keep track of them all. In fact, welcome back to the show, Clive. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. Thanks very much.
Very happy to have you back on the show here. I was telling him earlier, I'm not exactly sure where in the British Isles you're from, but you're an American hero to me. And,
well, it's very nice of you to say.
Yeah, yeah. But no, you did really important work.
Dorset, the center of the universe. Lovely place.
Oh, there you go. All right, cool. Well, so here's the thing. First of all, I believe I saw on Twitter today that your organization is proclaiming, maybe it's been proclaimed, and you're reminding us that today is the World Day Against the Death Penalty. Is that right?
That's right. It is indeed, yeah.
So tell us about that, how that come about, and what's happening with it.
Well, it's certainly been one of my obsessions over the years, but, you know, as the years have gone by, an increasing number of countries have decided that the death penalty doesn't achieve a whole lot, and the UN declared World Day Against the Death Penalty. They have a vote on a moratorium worldwide each year that is carried by a majority of countries, but unfortunately, of course, there are some who don't. Anyway, look, we can only aspire, and one day I hope we'll put it all behind us.
Mm-hmm. And can you talk about any kind of major organizations that are other than Reprieve, or you know, some projects that you guys are doing, or you know, anything important
yeah,
that
well,
people
look,
can learn about this?
Let me tell you a bit about a case that I've been very much involved in for the last 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. It's you know, the U.S. has 3,000 people on death row, but Pakistan has three times as many. There are 9,000 people on death row. Mm-hmm. And I was down there a while back, and the judge was telling me that he thinks 60% of them are innocent. And he was the same judge who was sentencing someone to death. Mm. But the case I've been dealing with is the case of a British national, a guy called Mohammed Asghar, who was sentenced to death for blasphemy because he allegedly put PBUH, as in peace be upon him, on his business card. So they sentenced him to death for that.
Oh,
now, you know, Mohammed Asghar is a profoundly mentally ill, paranoid schizophrenic who was in a mental hospital in Scotland until he was released, and then he went to Pakistan and put this on his business card. They sentenced him to death 4 years ago. He's been on death row now for 4 years. But 2 weeks ago last Thursday, a guard busted into his cell in the maximum security prison on death row there, shot him in the back and screamed death to the blasphemer. And, you know, Mohammed fortunately wasn't killed. He was injured and was taken to hospital. But, you know, this is the sort of thing that we're dealing with down there. And honestly, it's more dangerous representing blasphemers than it is representing multiple murderers, because the government in Pakistan has really ceded the land of reason to some of the people who misinterpret Islam in a way that's just pretty crazy.
Right. Yeah, exactly. It's completely open to interpretation. Any old thing could be considered blasphemy, you know, out of context or anything. Who knows?
Well,
it's like
true.
A witch hunt. Crazy. Absolutely crazy. And then, you know, I'm sure you're aware of this guy that was just released from death row here in Texas the other day, who it turns out, of course, well, I don't know, of course, but not surprisingly, the prosecutor had, you know, has been found not in trouble, but has been found to have been guilty of some kind of misconduct in the case in preventing the defense from knowing the whole thing. The guy had no ability to cooperate in his own defense. His publicly appointed lawyer completely sold him out, and it was on. It was his new wife had murdered her own baby, and it was pinned on him. And they knew that she was the one who did it, but they were happy to flip her against him so they could get two people. They didn't care that she was going to be getting out early and he'd be doing the hard time, even though she was the murderer, and they knew it.
Well, you know, I've spent much of today working on the case of a chap in Florida who was sentenced to death back for a crime in 1986 in Miami. And, you know, over the years, he's always insisted that he was innocent. And over the years, I've represented him now for 21 years. We've developed the evidence that proves he is. And in fact, you know, this is a crime that was committed. It was a murder of two unfortunate people in the DuPont Plaza Hotel in downtown Miami. And this was a murder committed by the Medellin cartel, Pablo Escobar. And, you know, my client, Chris Maharaj, 28 years in prison for something he absolutely didn't do. And yet he's still there. And we got him off death row, but he's still serving life. He's 75 years old. And it is patently clear to any reasonable person that he did nothing at all. He had nothing to do with the crime. And instead, it was all done by Pablo Escobar's people. And I've got a whole bunch of them now to say it. And yet he's still there. It is astounding to me that people are unwilling to accept when a mistake has been made. Because, you know, this isn't a statistic. This isn't a matter of, you know, 5% or 10% or whatever you may think. It's a matter of one human being who has only one life, who's spent almost three decades in prison for something he didn't do. It's just a crime.
All right, and then, yeah, and this is going on. Now, how many nations in the world, America's, what are America's peers when it comes to the death penalty on Earth? You mentioned Pakistan, where they execute blasphemers.
Pakistan has the death penalty. They don't really kill people. There are 192 members of the UN. There's a majority of countries that don't use the death penalty, about 130. There's very few that use it very much. Unfortunately, the ones that use it a lot and actually execute in order, they're China, Iran, the United States. Now, you know, that's not a company that we ought to want to be in. And, you know, it's one of those things that I think a lot of our friends, you know, in the U.S., you know, sometimes are just not aware of, that the overwhelming majority of the people who we call friends around the world have long since given up on the death penalty. And, you know, look, we haven't lost anything by giving up on it. It's not as if the death penalty achieves anything meaningful in terms of reducing crime.
Mm. All right. And now, can you tell me, I believe I read this, sir, but I'm sorry, I'm behind on things. Are you the lawyer for Abu Whale Daib in this court case here?
Oh, look, I'm involved in it, but actually all the heavy lifting is being done by other people in that reprieve. Corey Kreider and Alka Pradhan have been doing a lot of that, along with the law firm of Lewis Barks up there in Washington. And they've been having, I'm sure, as you know, this hearing for 3 days this week on the whole issue of force feeding.
Right. Yeah, we know Corey. I've interviewed her in the past many times. That's good to see. Was she always with Reprieve? Or that's new?
Yeah, she has. I mean, ever since she left law school, she has been one of the great stars of Reprieve.
Okay, I'm sorry. You know, I always confuse her, I think, with a great reporter with a similar name, too. But I've interviewed them both. Anyway, point is, she's doing great. I mean, tell us about the victory here, then.
Well, it's an astounding case, isn't it? And look, we put on three live witnesses, three medical professionals, including a general who was a military professional too, all of whom were very, very critical of the process of force feeding in Guantanamo. Now, of course, the military doesn't like to call it force feeding. They like to call it enteral feeding, but I was amused that one of them forgot and started talking about force feeding during this process. But all three of these experts talked about how it's one thing to force feed people to try and stop them from dying. I mean, look, I could perhaps accept that, even though as a medical matter it's considered unethical to force feed someone who's competent and who is on a hunger strike for a moral purpose. But that's not what's going on in Guantanamo. What's going on there is the force feeders, the people being force-fed, are being punished for their hunger strike.
All right, I'm sorry, and Clive. I got to interrupt you. I got to interrupt you so we can take this break. I'm real sorry.
Sure,
I didn't realize the time. We'll be right back, everybody, with Clive Stafford-Smith from Reprieve. Hey, Al Scott here for Whole Food Multicomplete at WholeFoodComplete.com. Whole Food Multicomplete is an entire supplement program in one bottle, containing 100% RDA of vitamins and minerals, plus live probiotics, digestive enzymes, antioxidant herbs, energy nutrients, and more. It's made in America using real foods and live probiotics. No chemical synthetics. It's soy-free, gluten-free, and independently tested and verified. They're so sure you'll love it, they're taking 20% off your first order with coupon code Scott Horton. Satisfaction is guaranteed at WholeFoodComplete.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Clive Stafford-Smith from Reprieve.
about very important developments in the case of the hunger strikers down at Guantanamo Bay and their force feedings. And I'm very sorry, Clive, for the interruption there.
No, not at all.
You were explaining that they're not saving these men's lives. They're punishing them for daring to try to starve themselves to death. Is that right?
Well, that's true. Look, one of the top rules in Guantanamo right now, which is very sad to say, is that it is illegal to protest. And Abu Wael, the client that you talked about, whose case is before the judge in Washington right now, he is in need of a wheelchair. He's disabled. And one of the punishments, if you'll believe it, that they imposed on him for daring to go on a hunger strike was they took away his wheelchair. They told him that if he was going to go on a hunger strike, he was going to be force-fed, and he either had to walk to his force-feeding or he would be what's called FCE, forcible cell extraction, where they basically beat him up. Now, for a long time, he'd been using his wheelchair, and they just said, no, you can't do it anymore. But, you know, that's just barbaric, and it's really beneath us. And it's very disappointing, I think, when the military takes that perspective. And thank goodness that the judge is actually having an open hearing now where we put on three live witnesses to testify about what's really going on. The government has refused to put on any witness live. They've submitted statements from people which they just read out in court. But they don't dare put any witnesses on live because they know we'll cross-examine them and show what's really happening.
Yeah. And now, can you tell us about this doctor that testified at the trial about the methods of force feeding?
Well, there were three different medical experts who testified, but they testified about the methodology. Now, you know, my problem with this goes all the way back to 2006 when they started using a process of making it intentionally, gratuitously painful. So, you know, before that, they were doing it in a way that, for example, they would leave the force-feeding tube up the prisoner's nose if he wanted it so he could, you know, keep it up there, and then they would force-feed him, but they would use small tubes so it wouldn't hurt as much and they wouldn't force the food into him. They wouldn't use this horrendous torture chair that they use now. So the whole process was much more humane. Then, unfortunately, just in the new year of 2006, General Vance Craddock was quoted in the New York Times. This is not me making this up. This is what he said in the New York Times. He said that we're going to make it less convenient, his words, for the prisoners to be on hunger strike, by which he meant they were going to make it gratuitously painful. Now, you know, that's just so sad. We should not be doing that. If we're going to force feed people to save their lives for humanitarian reasons, that's one thing. If instead we're going to make the force feeding gratuitously painful to try to abuse these prisoners so that they give up their peaceful strike, that's a very, very different thing. And it's just wicked, frankly, that the government's doing this.
Mm-hmm. Well, so they would claim that, hey, look at what a rock and a hard place position that we've been put in here. These people are trying to kill themselves. We have to save them.
Well, and look, that's illegal. The Tokyo Declaration of 1975 says that medical professionals can't do that if the prisoner is competent in making a competent decision. And you have to think about where these prisoners are. These guys have been there for 12 years without charge, without trial. They've been cleared. Many, you know, most of the people I represent have been cleared for 7 years. So on one level, it is perhaps reasonable that the prisoners want to go on a protest, even if it means that they die, like Bobby Sands with the IRA, if you remember that. But that's not the issue. The issue really isn't that. And frankly, if it was me, I'm not sure I would starve myself to death. The issue is, if the government genuinely believes that it has a moral duty to stop them from dying, if the government genuinely believes that it should override the medical rules of ethics, then they've got to do it in a humane way. They can't do it in a way that is intentionally trying to make it painful to try to force the people to give up their strike. That's just wrong. I mean, you know, look, you can't torture people just because they're doing something you don't like.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was reading a little bit about this, and I saw the magic word pneumonia, and I know people, I really like people who died of pneumonia. And I saw that that could be one of the results of stuffing the tubes down these men's throat all the time. What's up with that?
Well, yeah, I mean, look, there are different things that they were doing. For example, they were using olive oil as a lubricant to put the tubes down, which is just medically wrong. I mean, that can cause you to die under certain conditions. And look, with all of this, all we want is for the judge or for whomever to oversee what's going on down there. Because you know what happens when people behave in secret, act in secret. They start just believing their own fantasies. And one of, I was in Guantanamo last week. It was the 32nd time I've been down there, and frankly, it's not my Caribbean resort of choice. But things, in a way, have got worse in the last few years because, you know, people have lost interest in overseeing it and so on and so forth to such an extent that now you've got a bunch of prisoners who are desperate. I mean, 12 years. Take Shakarama. Shak has been there for 12 and a half years. His youngest child was born the day he got to Guantanamo, which was Valentine's Day 2002, 12 and a half years ago. And he was cleared in 2007 by George Bush. He was cleared again in 2009 by President Obama. He's still there. And his wife and four children are in London. There's no reason he couldn't go back to London tomorrow. He's just being held, and of course he's desperate. Anyone would be desperate under those circumstances. And he is absolutely, unalterably innocent, and no one can claim anything different.
Now, I read a piece by Ray McGovern late last night, too, about how at this trial, the government tried to call, they didn't even call an expert. They just sort of entered their own opinion as evidence or something somehow and tried to dispute the doctor who just left the room. And then someone called him back. He got word anyway. He called back and rebutted what they were saying. And
That was just a ridiculous thing. The government put on, they'd just done their little Google research themselves, you know. This is the level at which they're treating prisoners down there. So they were talking about how the size of tube, you know, we've claimed that you should use a number 8 tube or a number 10 tube, not the 14 tube that they're using, which is just really painful for the prisoners and which results in the food going in much faster and makes prisoners vomit. Now, they came up and said these are pediatrics. They're just for little children. And they're totally wrong. I mean, yes, to be sure, you use number 8 tubes for children, but that's to pump their stomachs, not to force feed them. And, you know, they just looked that up on Google and they're submitting it to the judge's evidence as if this is medical fact. So fortunately, the doctor was there and he came right back in and said, this is ridiculous. You know, you people can't even Google properly, let alone treat the prisoners properly.
Yeah. Well, it's the same thing as always, you know. What they're doing is criminal, so it needs a bunch of dishonesty to try to make it passable. And so,
you know, I wish that was true. I don't think that's true at all. I don't think people are being dishonest. I think they're just outright incompetent. And, you know, this is far more dangerous. If you're dealing with a dishonest, corrupt person, you can deal with that person much more easily. It's sort of like a corrupt police officer in a death penalty case. If you know that person's corrupt, you go around and you talk to his soon-to-be ex-spouse or whatever, and you get the truth out of people and you find out what's really going on. I've done that many times. The much greater problem are true believers, people who really believe that they're doing the right thing, but they're just emphatically wrong. Because the problem is they will then plow on and they're absolutely certain and they're zealots and all the rest of it. They're just wrong. They're much more dangerous because they'll look you in the eye, they'll swear up and down that it's true, they'll take a polygraph and they'll pass it, but they're just wrong.
Yeah. Well, and certainly one way or the other, they're wrong. For whatever reason, they're wrong. And
yeah,
they sure are dangerous. It's incredible. And I'm sorry that, you know, there's just too much. I was going to try to fit three subjects into this interview, and it's just not going to work. But I do want people to please go and read about this new report that Reprieve helped put together about the double tap drone strikes in Pakistan.
Sure.
That's a whole other interview in and of itself, but I'm afraid we got to go. But thank you very much for your time.
Thanks very much. I really appreciate it. Nice to talk to you.
Thank you. That's the great Clive Stafford Smith, y'all. He's at Reprieve. We'll be right back. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, so you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I saw a comment wondering about all the dead air in the introductions to these segments. Ah, see, you're listening to the minus version. The live audience? Well, right now they're listening to The Descendants singing Cool Guy. So when I'm dead air, they get to rock out a little bit, so it's not really dead air to them. Only to you when you listen to the archive later and you can't figure out why I stop talking for 20 seconds at a time at the beginning of these segments. Mystery solved for you. This show is live from noon to 3 Eastern Time on the Liberty Radio Network. All right. So our next guest on the show is Michael Clare, writing again at Tom Dispatch. And wait, let me fast forward to the end of the article so I can get his bio right here. He is Professor of Peace and World Security Studies. What a great name of a title of a professorship. Professor of Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College, and the author most recently of The Race for What's Left. And you can find him all the time at Tom Dispatch. Welcome back to the show, Michael. How are you doing?
Pleasure. Pleasure to be with you.
Yeah, good to have you here. You need in your title here and oil. Well, I guess The Race for What's Left, that betrays it right there. Real expert on global energy resources here, and especially what all it has to do with American foreign policy, which is a hell of a lot, of course. So this one is called Obama's New Oil Wars. Washington takes on ISIS, Iran, and Russia. So, well, actually, I like the way you start this article by going back to 1973 and talking about the oil weapon. Remind us about that for a minute.
Okay, well, when we talk about the oil weapon, at least back over time, we're usually talking about efforts by the Arab countries, the Arab members of OPEC, to punish the U.S. for its support of Israel by cutting off the flow of oil from the Middle East to the USA. And they did that most spectacularly in 1973, after the October War of 1973, Arab-Israeli War, to punish us for supporting Israel in that conflict. And it created those famous long gas lines in the United States when oil was scarce, and it triggered a global recession. So it had a tremendous impact on the U.S. and the rest of the world.
Wasn't that mostly them just trying to adjust the price of oil to the real value of the U.S. dollar at that point?
They did that as well. The OPEC countries as a whole raised oil prices to get a larger share of the income. But the Arab members of OPEC went further, and they actually cut off the flow of oil to the United States at that time.
I see. And so, well, and then I guess it was after that that they, well, let's see, 73. Yeah, so this was 2 years after they went off the gold standard. At what point had they worked out the so-called oil standard for the dollar, where the Saudis would promise to only denominate in dollars? That was before this, and they kept to that part of the deal even during the boycott. They didn't really change that. Do I understand right?
Well, yeah, they didn't change that because what you're talking about was something that all of the oil-producing countries were involved in. And, you know, and their aim was to increase the share of profits for oil sales that went to the home country instead of the oil companies, the Western oil companies that were getting all that money in the past. But the decision, the oil embargo of 1973 was done only, as I say, by a group of those countries, not all of them.
Right, I see. All right, so then now what you're saying is, I guess, that Washington learned a lesson from that, which they should have already understood quite well, right? With all the Rockefeller influence in the government, especially in the 70s, that, hey, oil is a hell of a weapon, isn't it?
And so that really does, I don't know, I guess I'll put it in the form of a question. How much exactly does oil have to do with the American empire and its policies around the world?
Oh, well, that's a topic I love to discuss, Scott, and I wrote a book about it called Blood and Oil that I tried to show that American foreign policy and military policy has largely been shaped by America's need for Middle Eastern oil and, as a result, a determination to control that part of the world as much as possible, to dominate the Persian Gulf area militarily and politically. And that's behind virtually everything that's happened for the past 50 years. The first Gulf War in 1990, the invasion of Iraq in 2003, and just about everything else that's happened in that area is a consequence of America's desire to dominate and control the oil-producing countries of that region. But what's happened lately is that oil production in the U.S. has risen so much that we're much less dependent on those countries. And that leads some policymakers to believe that now we can wield the oil weapon against people we don't like Iran and Russia and other countries and groups like ISIS. The question is whether this position we have is temporary or not, because other countries are also going to see what we're doing and they're going to retaliate.
Yeah. Isn't that funny that instead of, now that we have all this natural gas and we're, you know, virtually, you know, right around self-sufficient when it comes to energy resources in the United States and Canada anyway, that this isn't a time where now we can back off and just let the Middle East go to hell if it wants to, or do great if they want to, make deals with whoever they want to because it doesn't affect us. No, now we're just, as you put it, freed up to abuse the oil weapon, to use it to choke off and to wage kind of proxy war against adversary states even more than before.
Yeah, I think that's the belief of some in Washington, that we're in this powerful position and we could do what we want. I would say that's a very dangerous attitude to hold, because even though we're getting more of our oil from Texas and places in the U.S., North Dakota, through fracking, other countries are going to copy our behavior. And ultimately, we're all dependent on a price of oil that's affordable. And even if we get our oil at home, and there's a scarcity somewhere else, we're still going to see a rising prices in oil. So I believe using oil as an instrument of power is a bad idea in general.
Yeah. Well, and so it's funny because you have a gigantic continent like Africa, and you can see where in the West, America, I don't know what's the percentage. It's a pretty big one, right? Like 20% or something of America's daily oil supply comes from Nigeria or the Niger Delta there. Is that right?
That was the case up until a few years ago. However, because of the fracking boom, that has diminished. We're no longer quite as dependent on Africa as we once were. And we're getting more oil in the form of tar sands oil from Canada. So the balance of imports has shifted away from Africa and the Middle East for the United States. But our allies, Japan, the Europeans, they get their oil from Africa and the Middle East. And so we have to worry about the global picture, not just, you know, think that we can get by ourselves. That's not going to happen.
Well, when you see American moves in places like Uganda, where we're not getting oil from them, they're about as landlocked as hell, and to build a pipeline through a bunch of warring territories and this and that, it seems like the only thing that they can do, the only thing they can accomplish there is to try to prevent the Chinese from establishing, you know, too much of a dominant presence for a long term, just so that they can, what, choke the Chinese off someday. But it's surely not about, you know, making sure that I can pump that gas at the local 7-Eleven.
Yeah, well said, Scott. My sense is that there is a real debate about what the U.S. view should be on China's pursuit of oil. There are some who say is that, you know, that China is inevitably going to be our enemy and we should do everything to contain China, to prevent its rise, to deprive them of resources. But I think that's not in our best interests. I think we want to see China be able to get oil from other places in the world, because that the whole economy of the world will benefit that way.
Right. Yeah, as Reese Ehrlich said on the show the other day, hey, you look at how major powers deal with each other. They make deals, because what are they going to do, nuke each other? But when it comes to the poor and weak countries, look out. All right, now I'm sorry, we got to take this break. We'll be right back with more with Michael Clare, writing again at TomDispatch.com. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
Hey, cool. Remember how Clive was talking about his colleague Corey Kreider from Reprieve there? She's been interviewed by a stupid old Amanpour right now on CNNi, if you want to set your DVR there. She's the one who got the judge to rule they got to release the video of what they've done to this guy down at Guantanamo with the force feeding there. All right. Now, we're talking with Michael Clare. His piece at Tom Dispatch is Washington Wields the Oil Weapon. And it'll be running on antiwar.com tomorrow. And let's see. It's not your fault, it's mine. We're kind of all over the place here. But let's talk about the strikes against ISIS and their oil resources, such as they are. How much of an oil-producing state is Syria, or, I guess, Western Islamic State nowadays anyway?
Well, Syria was never among the major oil producers, but it produced enough to have some exports, and those exports were at one time one of the primary sources of income for the current regime, the existing Syrian government, Bashar al-Assad. But they've lost control over those oil fields. ISIS has taken over, and some by the al-Nusra Front as well. And so they're reaping the benefits of oil production in Syria. Now, it's not a huge amount. I calculated it as about 1/1,000th of world oil consumption, what ISIS is able to produce mm-hmm. in its captured oil fields. But hey, that's still at $90 a barrel, and they're producing, say, 100,000 barrels. That's a huge amount of money they're making every day. And that's where they get the money to pay all of these foreign volunteers that are coming in to join ISIS. They get paid a lot more, in many cases, than they would being unemployed kids somewhere in Europe or in Beirut or in Egypt or those countries. So the oil is enough to give ISIS its working capital.
Mm. And now, but how much is that exactly? Because I read this thing. It was not the actual Rand Corporation study, but it was an article by the author of it anyway. And he was pretty alarmed, saying these guys are making as many as $2 million a day, which I think Travis County, Texas, pulls in every, 4 or 5 minutes or something like that. That their total budget this year may be as high as $2 billion, which even he said, yeah, that's probably just enough to pay the wives of the dead fighters their pensions for a little while. And basically, I mean, we're talking about the flattest, brokest wannabe state in the whole wide world here, right?
I think you have to put this into perspective. I can't think of another terrorist organization, which ISIS is, that has that kind of a money.
Right. And biggest terrorist organization, smallest government.
Yes, it's probably the smallest. The Islamic State is the smallest state, and it's a state ruled by terror. It's not a really functioning state. But the fact is that they're able to attract fighters to their cause, not necessarily out of ideological commitment, which is the case in most of the other terrorist groups, but because you get paid a damn good salary for somebody who's 19 years old, has no education and no job prospects. They're getting, I'm told, 100 euros, about $125 a week. And, that's a lot more than mostly that they're other young men like that in their part of the world ever are going to see. So it is attracting. They are producing enough wealth to finance their army, and it makes them a formidable opponent as a result.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like it could be an important weakness, though, too, if their whole army is simply mercenary and it's only their very core that are actually the true believers of this thing. Although I guess it depends on whether their fortunes are on an upswing at any given moment.
Yes, I think that's the right way to look at it. I think that while their fortunes appear to be on the upswing, they're going to attract people and they're going to be able to pay them, and this is looking like a good thing, a promising thing. I believe that this will not last for very long because their methods are so demonic, so horrific, that they're alienating people who are within the state. I mean, not only are they making enemies on the periphery in all directions, but they claim to be a state, but a functioning state that survives for any length of time has to have the support of the people to a certain point, or at least their cooperation, even if they're unhappy. But if you're terrorizing the population, they're going to rebel against ISIS, and I think its days are numbered over the next coming years.
Sure, yeah, absolutely. I know you know well that back in 2006 and 2007, and certainly many things have changed since then, but back then, when they first renamed al-Qaeda in Iraq, the Islamic State of Iraq, everybody laughed at them, and especially the local Sunni tribal leaders and religious authorities and so forth, who said, yeah, right, you guys are a bunch of Libyans and Syrians and Saudis come to help us, and you're welcome to help us. In fact, maybe not so much now, but you sure as hell aren't the bosses of us. You know, we are the tribes of Iraq. You are not the Islamic State of Iraq, they said. And so there's no reason to think they're going to do much better this time. I mean, they're in a better position this time, obviously, power-wise. But I agree with you that, you know, that's why I'm recommending, hey, everybody, listen to what he said. Hands off. We don't have to support the Iranians. We don't have to support anybody, the Saudis or Assad or anybody against these guys. The local Sunnis they're attempting to force their rule on are going to be the end of them sooner or later. They're outnumbered. And like you said, their methods are so horrible that there cannot be popular sovereignty of any kind anywhere they go. They can rule only by terror, and that only goes so far. Unless you have a German Reich to use against people, which they don't.
Yeah. Well, I think you said it better than I could. That reflects my sense of where things are going. Already some of the Sunni tribes are turning against them, even though in Iraq, even though those tribes were very bitterly opposed to the al-Maliki regime in Iraq, the Shiite-dominated al-Maliki regime. But now there's been a change in Baghdad, a greater effort to reach across to the Sunnis, and I think under those circumstances there'll be increasing revolt against ISIS in the territory it claims to control.
All right, now we're almost out of time. What about you? Could you stay one more segment, or do you need to run?
I need to run, Scott.
Oh, that's unfortunate.
I have to teach.
Well, yep. Okay, well, good for your students. I guess we'll have to get back to the discussion about Iran and Russia later, because there's a lot of very important stuff there, too. So, but thanks very much for your time again on the show and for writing this great article. Good to talk to you.
Great. Bye-bye.
Bye. That's Michael T. Clare, everybody. He is at tomdispatch.com. Washington wields the oil weapon. And he's a professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College and the author most recently of The Race for What's Left. And he also has a book called Blood and Oil. And I really think you guys will appreciate this article. It'll run tomorrow at antiwar.com. And so now the music starts. I cut him off a little bit early, didn't I? I know what I'll do. I'll fill this space with telling you to go read Brent Scowcroft from 2002, Don't Attack Saddam, in the Wall Street Journal. I think you'll laugh at a couple of places, or cry, depending on how close you are to people who died in that war, I guess. Hey, Al Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. Well, dang, I talked with Michael about too many things. And no time to talk Pakistan with Clive. No time to talk about Iran and Russia with Michael. I think I kind of blew the first part of that interview. I don't know. Nah, it's important stuff. Anyway, you should read his article. Hey, good. That half-hour interview, well, two 10-minute segments, I guess. That 20-minute interview made for a great teaser, but the rest of his article is all about America using oil as a weapon against Iran and Russia. And as he said, as America's more energy independent, the empire is more free to beat other countries over the head with oil supplies and disruptions to them. All right. Well, anyway, yeah, you'll want to read that. It's at tomdispatch.com. It'll be at antiwar.com tomorrow as well. Now, I thought this was funny. You know, if you're an anti-empire type, it's funny. So, there's this thing at Interpress Service today. When helping hands make a disaster worse, and you think, wow, cool, some James Bovardian criticism of do-gooderism here. And, oh, wow, it's about Haiti, too. And the caption of the picture talks about how the United Nations came and crapped in the water supply and spread cholera among all the pathetic, helpless earthquake victims of Haiti. I'm not insulting them. I'm saying they were helpless before the might of the all-powerful earth, which shook the ground out from under their society, so to speak. And then I swear to you, the whole problem here is not about cholera. If you read this article, you know what the problem is? The UN came to town and gave these people plastic forks and plastic water bottles, and that's going to cause global warming someday. No, really. I couldn't make that up no matter how much I hate liberals. I just couldn't. Well, I guess I could. It sounds like something you'd read in The Onion or something. Somebody could make it up. Oh, 550,000 new trees will be needed to offset the carbon emissions from the discarded tents. The discarded tents. Which, you know, is going to cause the earth to bake you to death. And then you'll die. And then you'll be helpless. All right, well, just so you know, you know. Also, this one, are we running today on AntiWar.com? I forget which all's on the page today or which is running tomorrow or what, but it's our friend Sheldon Richmond over at the Future Freedom Foundation. And he says, is Obama trying to alienate Muslim American youth? A 19-year-old Chicago area man was arrested last weekend for attempting to help the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. The U.S. government says Mohammed Hamza Khan, an American citizen, faces 15 years in the pokey because he was at an airport with a ticket to Turkey and had left references to ISIS and a note to his parents saying he was going to Syria. I wonder, was it an undercover informant that convinced him to do it? What are the odds? Good. Meanwhile, the Obama administration says it will step up outreach efforts with American Muslims to counter ISIS's campaign to attract young Western Muslims to its cause. Is this any way for the government to keep the turmoil in Iraq and Syria from washing up on America's shores? Anyway, he goes on about how, at a time when the government says we're really at risk, not just for ISIS attacks, but for lone wolf attacks, where, in other words, American Muslims come to identify with the victims of American foreign policy more than the government that's carrying those policies out.
and then may or may not turn against us in a lone wolf attack, as they say. And so Sheldon says, well, if that's the case, it seems like you would need the local Muslim community to like and respect the police and consider themselves part of that same American community that the police are part of, too. Ahem. And so that then, if there really is a problem, the locals will feel okay. Not like they're being a damned rat, but like they're really doing the right thing. If they say, hey, FBI, there's a guy down at the mosque who's really causing trouble. I mean, of course, if that's going on, probably that guy is the FBI informant in the first place. And so, don't you buy him a sandwich or you're providing material support to an undercover FBI agent attempting to entrap you into some fake crime. And so what do American Muslims think of the U.S. government? Well, the same thing all Americans ought to think of the U.S. government. These people are our enemy. They are villains. They are criminals. They are terrible. And as Clive Stafford Smith was pointing out, also they're stupid and believe their own crap a lot of the time, which makes them even more especially dangerous. And so, since the police agencies still claim a monopoly on policing powers in America, what are leaders of local Muslim communities across America supposed to do? When chances are, if there is a bad guy causing trouble in the community, maybe trying to recruit somebody else to be his useful idiot or whatever, that they'd be right to assume most of the time that that guy himself is working for the cops. Just trying to find somebody to get in trouble. I mean, when you hear feds bust guy at airport, you think that's really because he bought a ticket to Turkey and he had left something about ISIS on his Facebook page? I don't believe that. I think they made that up later, took two little scraps of their entrapment job and fed them to us. And I'm not saying I know. I hadn't paid close attention to this case. It may be that they've already admitted that he was in on it with an FBI agent. Lately, they're not even shy about it. Oh, yeah, us? Yeah, we entrapped this stupid kid because he is stupid, and so, but it makes us look good, so cheese, take a picture, doing a good job protecting you from terrorism we create, the government claims. And by the way, you want to read the book on this? Trevor Aronson from Mother Jones Magazine. He wrote the book, Terror Incorporated. Of course, it's about the FBI, whose job is drumming up fake terrorist attacks. And by the way, speaking of FBI agents who do nothing but threaten and harass and intimidate and violate the rights of American Muslims and entrap the weaker minded of them into these stupid plots. At the same time, these pigs have no idea the Americans who've gone to Turkey and then to Syria to fight in this jihad the last 3 years. Why? Because America's been supporting the jihad. Just like back in the day in Chechnya, just like back in the day in Bosnia, just like back in the day a little further in Afghanistan in the 1980s. Just like in 2011 in Libya. And so, why would the FBI, any FBI agent who was tracking Americans who were going to fight with the jihad in Syria, he might be stepping on political toes and get in trouble with the political appointees running the thing. No, Obama and the American government are on the side of Al-Qaeda in this one. Get it straight, gumshoe. So, the FBI agents, I just imagine that could be one excuse of theirs. Maybe they have no excuse whatsoever. I have considered that possibility as well. The FBI does not have a folder full of which Americans have gone to fight with ISIS. They have not. That's not part of their job. They've been busy chasing their tail, running around in circles, and trapping idiots into saying they love Osama. Into pushing a button on a fake switch. And meanwhile, dozens, it's not that big of a threat. I'm not trying to be too big a scaremonger about the consequences, but it just goes to show these guys are the ones in charge of protecting us. FBI to public at CBS News. Help us identify foreign fighters. Have any of your neighbors gone to fight with the jihad in Syria? Please let us know, they say. We have no idea, they say. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. I want to tell you about this great new book, Livin' La Vida Baroka, American Culture in an Age of Imperial Orthodoxies by Thomas Harrington. While he comes from the left, Harrington has little time for much of what is passed off under that label today. Like us libertarians, he puts peace and freedom first. The book's got great essays on American fascism, empire, the Israeli occupation, the left and Obama, liberalism in the state, and some interesting lessons from the history of Imperial Spain. Livin' La Vida Baroka by Thomas Harrington. Check it out at scotthorton.org/books or scotthorton.org/Amazon. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. 67 killed in suicide bombings in Yemen. New Yemen prime minister resigns after opposition from rebels. So what happened was the Houthi rebellion in the north, well, it come to the capital city and conquered it a couple of weeks ago. Well, the parliament appointed a new prime minister, and the Houthis, who, I don't know if you call them the Houthi rebellion anymore, I'm not so sure they're a rebellion. They're a rebel one. They said, we don't like him. He resigned before he got resigned, which was probably a good move, you know, there on his part. Now Al-Qaeda's come to town. Al-Qaeda's no longer at war with America's sock puppet dictatorship in Sana'a. Now they're at war with the Houthis, who just dislodged it. So it's Al-Qaeda versus the Shiite Houthis in the capital city there. And whatever became of the socialists in the south, do they still have their own organized, armed kind of resistance movement or not? And the protesters of 2011, I guess they run like hell a long time ago, huh? And what a disaster. And, you know, it was reminding me of what we were talking about there a little bit with Clive Doyle. I mean, why do I always call him that? Clive Doyle, I'm sorry, is the surviving Branch Davidian, the poor bastard. Clive Stafford Smith, about the olive oil, it's not water soluble. So when they use olive oil to lubricate the tube that they cram down these Guantanamo prisoners' throats, it doesn't get absorbed, you know, eventually, and circulated and whatever, etc. It can stay there and cause pneumonia in their lungs. Yeah. And so I was saying, hey, isn't that sort of attempted murder or something like that? Some kind of a assault and battery sort of thing. And the doctor at the trial got really pissed. He said, this is not controversial, okay? I looked at all of the literature. It's got to be water-soluble. Said anybody's ever made a salad knows that olive oil is not water-soluble. This could be deadly. See? Anyway, so the thing is I was thinking of, man, I know a couple of really good people just off the top of my head, maybe more than that. Oh, geez, I know some I won't mention that are personal, now that I think about it. But, well, J.D. Cash and Jeff Huber, both two of my favorite writers. J.D. Cash, the great intrepid reporter on the real story of the Oklahoma City bombing. And Jeff Huber, who was the great satirist, who just cut St. David Petraeus and his desert ox Odierno into tiny little pieces with his razor-sharp keyboard on a regular basis. He was just so brilliant. He was so great. He was a friend of the wife's and a friend of mine as well. Great guy. Separately, and then, you know, yeah. But anyway, so he died of pneumonia too back a few years ago. But one of the last things that he wrote before he died was called Osama Bin Laden, Dead and Loving It. And it was about how Osama bin Laden achieved every single thing that he stated he was setting out to accomplish. First and foremost of those being, well, he was in the state of accomplishing them. Not done. But his goals were to bankrupt the American Empire and diminish its influence in the Middle East. He would have preferred totally, not quite there yet. But certainly that has taken place in great measure to help to destabilize and discredit the American sock puppet regimes in the region, who already were perceived as illegitimate by their people. Of course, these sultans and emirs and kings and potentates ruling the Arabian Peninsula, for example. But all America's done is make them look that much worse for being the sock puppets of the Americans who came and murdered the million Iraqis after they were done starving a million to death before that, and hiring Saddam to kill half a million of them, throwing them up against the Iranian wall before that. And anyway, just wanted to destabilize and discredit all those dictators, and absolutely has succeeded in that. Now, of course, hadn't driven the Israelis out of Palestine, hadn't accomplished that, and Osama is dead at the bottom of the sea, so he didn't get to become the caliph. But just think, if he had lived only 3 more years hiding in that attic up there, where his caliphate was a tiny little pathetic joke, 3 years later, there's a real-ass, some kind of pseudo-state. I don't know if it's a real-ass state. You measure it however you like. It's a matter of quality, not quantity. But it seems like they pretty much have a monopoly on force in the land between, you know, in the eastern frontier, Mosul and Tikrit. And in the west, they're all the way to, I don't know, what, like 100 miles from the Mediterranean Sea? Certainly they control Raqqa, and they're all the way at the Turkish border now in Kobani there. And yeah, they have a monopoly on power. They have waged a successful regime change and taken over that territory. If you watch the Vice documentary, they run the local civilian, the local civil courthouse, I mean to say. They've taken over and are operating as a state. Hey, my brother-in-law ripped me off on the price of them chickens. He was supposed to kick back to me. And they go before the local magistrate. That kind of crap. Low-level civil disputes are being resolved by the Islamic State in not out sitting on the ground somewhere like the Taliban, Loya Jirga, but in their offices. Looks like the local DMV. It's a nightmare. Totalitarian nightmare, I tell you. But no, I'm just saying it looks more and more like an actual state. It seems like it. I think they have the power to repel any invaders, any likely invaders in the neighborhood anyway. But anyway, point being that America, the U.S. government, has accomplished all of Osama bin Laden's goals for him. They blew $6 trillion on the Iraq and Afghan wars. Now, they have not gotten rid of the Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran. Osama would have loved that. Looks like maybe we're going to go ahead and make peace with Iran, hopefully on the nuclear deal. Hopefully not too much peace where we forge an actual alliance and go to war with them against the Sunni Iraqis. We don't want nothing like that. Ronald Reagan era again, only on the Iranian side of the Iran-Iraq war. Well, George Bush already did that, 03 through 011, so, well, 08 really, 09, 010. Don't want too much peace with them. And of course, Osama would love to see the government of Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates and Qatar and Bahrain and Oman and Kuwait all fall. But, you know, that just may be more and more in the cards. Even as the Islamic State is disobeying bin Laden's right-hand man, Zawahiri, and going ahead and creating the caliphate now and all that kind of thing, the Americans bringing all of the Gulf states into battle against them only undermines their authority that much more. It undermines America's authority. You know, Biden says in Biden's famous rant here, I could play it, his rant where he's blaming all of America's allies for financing the rise of ISIS and refusing to take any responsibility for the Americans at all. He's also saying, but it's so important that we are not leading this battle, that the Saudis and these other Sunni governments are the ones, so that we're not seen as leading it. Well, give me a break. America's the empire with the superpower. They're the, you know, tacked on coalition of the willing for pretended legitimacy. But who in all of the Islamic caliphate thinks, oh, good, the essence of legitimate authority, the king of Saudi Arabia is coming. And he's bringing the Americans with him. And that legitimizes the Americans because of the just unbelievable legitimacy that the Saudi king brings to bear with him. That he blesses legitimacy on all white Christian allies from the other side of the planet that he brings with him to come and fight. Oh, these guys, from many of whom are Iraqi, the Islamic State leaders. Baghdadi himself, they say, is from Samarra, not Baghdad, but still. He's an Iraqi. Most of their leadership are Iraqi or at least Syrian. But they're not declaring themselves kings. They've got this whole shtick about it's not about them. And, you know, I think they probably believe that. I think Michael Scheuer, I'm just guessing, but I bet you Michael Scheuer would say that bin Laden wouldn't have cared that he died and that this guy Baghdadi was the one who declared himself caliph. That murderous bastard. It really was not about all personal ambition for him so that, I mean, I'm sure he would have thought it was nice if he could have been the one to declare himself the leader of the new Islamic State over there. But he don't care. And Baghdadi and his men, apparently they have at least the same PR. They walk around in suicide belts all day as though it's not about them. And maybe they do believe it. Maybe that does make them more dangerous.